Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. A lot going on. Gina Haspel is testifying before the Senate right now. Some people are, you know, giving her hugs and kisses, and others are trying to take her down. It's, you know, interesting. But and in fact, I want to get into that at some length in about 15 minutes from now. But right now, Jamal Abdi is with us. He is the Vice President for Policy with the National Iranian American Council, NIAC. He is the Executive Director of NIAC Action. NIAC.org is their website. And you can tweet him at Jabdi, at J-A-B-D-I. Jamal, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for joining us. So what would war, now that, you know, Trump has blown up the Iran deal, and in my opinion, and the opinion of many others, I'm assuming that you would share this. If not, please let me know. Has moved us much closer to the possibility of a war, particularly a war that might be started by, or mediated by, or incited by. Maybe "started" is too strong a word. By either Saudi Arabia or Israel, two principal antagonists of Iran in the region. Not to mention what's going on in Iraq. You know, assuming that we have now moved the atomic clock forward, as it were, you know, the probability of war with Iran has increased. What would a war with Iran look like?
Well, the United States actually conducted war games in the early 2000s, and they actually had to stop the exercise and recalibrate it because the damages to the United States or to U.S. troops in the region were so devastating that they actually had to reset the rules. Iran has basically set up its security sort of posture as one of asymmetric capabilities. Iran is sort of outstriped in terms of its, conventional military, equipment and other things by the other powers in the region who are benefiting from major U.S. support and buying weapons from the U.S. and others on a scale of, 5-1, 10-1 compared to Iran. But what Iran has done is invested in its ability to, strike targets in the Persian Gulf and mine the Gulf and make the Persian Gulf sort of a theater where they could potentially, cause a lot of loss of lives.
Well, they could. My understanding is about a third of the world's oil goes through the Straits of Hormuz.
That's right.
Which they have the ability to shut down.
Right. So if there's sort of a scorched earth approach that they need to take, they could effectively shut the Strait of Hormuz down. And then you look at the, sort of the U.S. troop presence in the region and how, after sort of during the nuclear talks and since then, Iran has sort of tamped down on these militias or proxies or whatever you want to call them in Iraq, in other places in the region, but have sort of you know, this issue of U.S. troops being threatened by Iranian proxies and things like that, that has not been an issue for many years now. And the Iranians sort of turned that off, and I think that they could really quickly turn that back on and, you know, make a mess in Iraq. Already we're seeing the situation in Syria, but I think that could escalate really significantly. And then you look at Iranian proxies like, you know, Hezbollah, and that's obviously, you know, a big concern of Israel. But the point being that there are a lot of ways that Iran could make life very difficult for the U.S. and U.S. allies.
So this could become a self-fulfilling prophecy really quickly, couldn't it? I mean, if, for example, Iran was found to be supportive of Shia militia in Iraq who are destabilizing that country, although Iran, it seems, has an incentive to have a stable Iraq in that, you know, I mean, the first multinational business to open in Baghdad was the Bank of Tehran, you know, back in the day. I mean, but if Iran was being problematic in Iraq and, you know, the channels of information in the United States, our news media, were rattled really aggressively to make sure that Americans knew about this. And then, for example, Saudi Arabia or Israel decided to take a shot at Iran over whatever's happening in the, you know, whether it's something in Syria with Saudi Arabia or whether it's something in Lebanon, Israel, whatever. And at that point, the American public is already primed to kind of hate Iran because of Iran because of the role that they're playing in Iraq. Then we could be in a war in the region with Americans waving American flags going, yeah, bad guys, go get them. I mean, hasn't Trump fundamentally changed the dynamic so that that's not just a small slice of the right-wing Republicans, you know, world that would cheer such a thing, but that he might even get the all of America behind him in a war?
Yeah. That right now, the public does not support a war with Iran, would not support another, you know, U.S. war of choice in the region. You know, nobody really knows fully what we're doing in Syria or even Iraq for that matter, or Yemen for that matter. But any sort of public, you know, let's go to war with Iran is not going to be supported until you goad Iran into doing something stupid and you get that tit for tat that is already happening right now between Iran and Israel in Syria. But I think you could quickly have a, you know, an incident. I don't want to say a Gulf of Tonkin incident, but something that does.
Well, it could be real. I mean, the two Israeli missiles were apparently shot down this morning in Syria.
Yeah, that's the likely flashpoint, and that's really the big fear. And, you know, Trump has surrounded himself with people like John Bolton who support regime change in Iran and want to, you know, have called for bombing Iran for years. And then the, you know, supposed adults in the room that still remain in the room are people like James, you know, Mad Dog Mattis, who's the voice of reason. But even Mattis supports, you know, stepping up actions against Iran throughout the region and sort of countering Iranian interests throughout the region. And so if you can combine those two viewpoints, you're looking at a very devastating cocktail to get the U.S. involved in a war with Iran.
So Saudi Arabia and Israel seem to be the two countries that are most enthusiastic about, I wouldn't say about our having a war with Iran, that's probably overspeak, but certainly enthusiastic about behaviors that arguably could lead to a war by the United States with Iran. And, you know, that people have made the wry joke, you know, that Saudi Arabia and Israel are perfectly willing to have America fight Iran to the last dead American soldier. What are the internal dynamics in those countries that are driving this?
Well, I think Benjamin Netanyahu wants to stay out of jail, for one thing.
You think he's using this as a way to divert attention away from his own corruption problems?
You know, fundamentally, this has always been about sort of, you know, balance of power in the region and wanting to contain Iran and wanting to sort of, for the Israelis as well as the Saudis, sort of reserve their fiefdoms and their security, you know, buffers and things like that. But it really, it's a battle between that side and the Iranian side, and the U.S. has sort of been along for the ride. For Netanyahu specifically, though, we have seen him time and time again sort of use this for his own political fortunes and to play to his own political base. And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if a motivating factor right now was that a securitized environment plays well for Netanyahu. He has been indicted. He is looking at jail. I'm sure he has plenty of motivations for continuing to do this, because he has consistently been pushing for an antagonistic and even militaristic approach towards Iran. But I think that it's particularly acute right now, given his own
political situation. Is it, you know, if Mueller comes out with an actual indictment against Trump or against his son-in-law or one of his sons, that he could take us to war simply to shut down all conversation about anything other than war and executive powers. You think Netanyahu is playing that game? Or would be interested
in playing that game? I think he is.
Do you think that the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia is playing that game? I mean, he's got a lot of dissent within his kingdom.
I think for him it's he has risen in power and he is rising based on, I think it's a ideological, you know, contest for him, and it's also about what he perceives as Saudi interests, which is to defeat Iran and to keep Iran, you know, checked.
Right.
I don't know, you know, I see him actually, he has sort of the wind at his sails right now. So really this is how he has risen to power, is by, you know, being more confrontational with Iran and Yemen and these other places. And it's really been pretty devastating for Saudi Arabia, but this is sort of where he is ideologically.
Yeah, remarkable. In the last minute we have here, we're talking with Jamal Abdi, the Vice President for Policy at the National Iranian American Council, NIAC.org. Jamal, how, you know, it looks like Iran is going to be moving forward playing the role of adults. You know, we're going to work out a deal with China, Russia, and our European allies, the UK, Germany, and France. Screw America. I mean, you know, they don't have any. Trump has pulled them out of the involvement. We don't have anything to worry about here. We're not going to deal with them. And then the question is, will the Europeans go along with American sanctions on companies like Airbus? Very briefly here, we have just a minute left. How do you expect this to play out?
I'm not very hopeful about Europe really standing tall. The rhetoric has been really great the past day or so. I think that Europe really committed a strategic mistake by really kind of bending over backwards to meet Trump at his terms. And I think that signaled to the Trump administration they can boss these guys around. And so we'll see if Europe has a change of heart and is able to present a unified front and protect its companies from sanctions and things like that.
So you're saying that Merkel
really isn't coming on them.
Merkel, Boris Johnson, and Macron, instead of flattering Trump and rubbing his back and telling him what a wonderful guy he was, we can just tweak this deal a little bit so you can take credit for it, you know, get that horrible Obama name out of it, that actually caused Trump to think that they were weak.
Absolutely. They should have called it out for the disingenuous effort that it was. This is always about getting out of the deal.
Yeah, that makes absolute sense. And, so many of us just winced to see Macron doing everything except shine Donald Trump's shoes. You know, it's just, it's bizarre. Jamal Abdi, VP of Policy at NIAC, Executive Director of NIAC Action, NIAC.org is the website. You can tweet him at G-A-B-D-I, or G-A, yeah, D-I.
J-A-B-D-I. Right?
Yeah, great. J Abdi. Jamal, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Great talking to you. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is serious stuff. I mean, we need to be taking this very seriously. We'll be back with torture after this. Welcome back to the place where smart people get their news. President Obama. Oh, does it sound nice to say that? President Barack Obama, no longer president, but hey, he's the last president that I recognize, has issued a statement. And it's unfortunate that it's not getting anything close to the coverage that it should get. But then we've got a, by and large, Republican-controlled media on television, in radio, and in print. And so it shouldn't surprise you. But President Obama said, this is from yesterday, today's announcement is so misguided. He's talking about the U.S. pulling out of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, the Iran deal. He said, walking away from the JCPOA turns our back on America's closest allies and on an agreement that our nation's leading diplomats, scientists, and intelligence professionals negotiated. In a democracy, there will always be changes in policies and priorities from one administration to the next, but the consistent flouting of agreements that our country is a party to risks eroding America's credibility and puts us at odds with the world's other major powers. And then he goes through the JCPOA, the Iran deal, and just goes through the details of it. He said, first, this is President Obama. First, the JCPOA was not just an agreement between my administration and the Iranian government. After years of building an international coalition that could impose crippling sanctions on Iran, we reached the JCPOA together with the United Kingdom, France, Germany, the European Union, Russia, China, and Iran. It is a multilateral arms control deal unanimously endorsed by the United Nations Security Council. Second, the JCPOA has worked in rolling back Iran's nuclear program. For decades, Iran had steadily advanced its nuclear program, approaching the point where they could rapidly produce enough fissile material to build a bomb. The JCPOA put a lid on that breakout capacity. Since the JCPOA was implemented, Iran has destroyed the core of a reactor that could have produced weapons-grade plutonium. They have removed two-thirds of their centrifuges, over 13,000 of them, and placed them under international monitoring. They have eliminated 97% of its stockpile of enriched uranium, the raw materials necessary for a bomb. So by any measure, President Obama said, the JCPOA has imposed strict limitations on Iran's nuclear program and achieved real results. Third, the JCPOA does not rely on trust. It is rooted in the most far-reaching inspections and verification regime ever negotiated over a nuclear and an arms control deal. Iran's nuclear facilities are strictly monitored. International monitors also have access to Iran's entire nuclear supply chain so that if they cheat, we can catch them. Without the JCPOA, this monitoring and inspections regime will go away. Fourth, Iran is complying with the Iran deal, the JCPOA. This is not simply the view of my administration. The United States intelligence community has continued to find that Iran is meeting its responsibilities under the deal and has reported as much to Congress. So have our closest allies and the international agency responsible for verifying Iranian compliance, the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA. Fifth, the Iran deal, the JCPOA, does not expire. The prohibition on Iran ever obtaining a nuclear weapon is permanent. Some of the most important and intrusive inspections codified by the JCPOA are permanent. Even as some of the provisions in the JCPOA do become less strict over time, this won't happen until 10, 15, 20, or 25 years into the deal. So there's little reason to put those restrictions at risk today. And finally, he says the JCPOA was never intended to solve all our problems with Iran. We were clear-eyed that Iran engages in destabilizing behavior. But that's precisely why it was so important that we prevented Iran from attaining a nuclear weapon. And, you know, he goes on from there. But this is President Barack Obama calling out these guys. This is amazing stuff. Vi in Donovan, Missouri. Am I saying that right?
Donovan.
Okay, what's up, Vi?
I'm just wanting everyone to fire an email off to their senator about Gina Haspert and her nominations to the directorship of the CIA.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she would be a horrible director, and I think maybe the whole world's watching to see if we reward people who've been involved in torture.
And destruction of evidence of crimes.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I agree with you, Vi, and I think, and, you know, I watched much of her testimony this morning, and I thought that she did a really nice job of portraying herself as hey, I was just following orders. It seemed like the right thing to do at the time. I wouldn't do it again. You know, I've learned my lessons. I'm reformed now. She didn't say any of those things explicitly, but that was the implicit message of everything she said. And I'm sure there's no shortage of people who have been, you know, before a court at their pre-sentencing hearing, who have tried to, you know, convince people how wonderful they've become and all the marvelous things they've done with their lives and whatnot, and how they've changed. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that she participated in a crime under U.S. law and a crime under international law, and then she participated in the cover-up of a crime under U.S. law and international law. And such a person should not be rewarded with the directorship of the agency, in my opinion. Vi, thank you for the call. Well said. David in Columbus, Ohio. Hey, David, thanks for listening to WGRN. What's up?
Yeah, hi. I think our policy in the Middle East has been vague. Well, we seem to support Israel no matter what.
And, that's been the one consistent, that and Saudi Arabia have been the two consistent pieces of our Middle Eastern policy, for better or for worse.
I think it's based on arms sales. It's not based on a rational observation of how the countries are performing as far as human rights or domestic policies. I think all those countries deserve to be preserved and They don't. We shouldn't be. There shouldn't be any countries attacking other countries. But I think as long as they're stable and they're not attacking each other, we shouldn't stir things up. And I think the Trump administration is the worst as far as stirring things up because they want to sell more arms. Mm. So the American public needs an alternative, and the Democrats should come out with policies that show the difference between Republicans and Democrats on foreign and domestic policy.
Yeah. I think with regard to policy around Saudi Arabia, there's not as much of a clear and vivid divide in either political party. But when it comes to policies around Israel, in the Democratic Party, there is a clear split between those who see Israel as, over the last decade or so under Netanyahu, as having become more and more of a hard right country and more of a, essentially an apartheid state, versus those who are, you know, Israel right or wrong, it doesn't matter, you know, I'm committed to the idea of a Jewish state in the Middle East and the only democracy in the region and, you know, surrounded by enemies who want to destroy them. And those two narratives are the two counter narratives that are I don't know if they're equally represented in the Democratic Party, but they're two narratives that are represented. And it's really easy to demonize either one, which, you know, partisans on the other side do. Whereas in the Republican Party, it's mostly, hey, we're Christians, and we want Jesus to return, and Jesus is only going to return, according to the Bible, when they build the Second Temple in Jerusalem. And the Second Temple, you know, once the Second Temple, which is what Alan Goodman tried to do back in the 1980s when he went to the Dome of the Rock and tried to put up a tent there and with a machine gun killed a bunch of Arabs, and he was trying to bring back Jesus. And I mean, there's a whole faction of Messianic Jews who are into this as well, you know. Mashiach Now is a bumper sticker that you can see in Israel. And so, you know, the right-wing so-called Christians in the Republican Party, you know, the Bible says you've got to have the Second Temple, plus you've got to have the population, the Jewish population of Israel, reduced to 144,000 people, who then at the last minute in the last days will all convert to Christianity, and then Jesus reappears. And the Israelis have been playing a really dangerous role over the years, and I've been to Israel many, many times, and I've spent a lot of time in Israel, playing footsie with these hardcore right-wing Christians. You know, hey, we're perfectly happy to take their money, give them tours, you know, help them support Israel, take their political support, even though we realize that ultimately they're calling for the death of all the Jews in Israel. And it's just, it has, David, thank you for the call. It has become a very, you know, a very complicated and messy situation, frankly. And one that, you know, typically I'm not a big fan of getting into those debates on this program. But I think that it's now that particularly Netanyahu has become the tail that is wagging the dog of the United States. You got Donald Trump, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu doing an English television presentation at the time that he knows Trump is going to be watching, and then Trump does what he wants. There's something wrong with that.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I realize Netanyahu is looking at possibly going to prison for corruption and all that kind of stuff, and he wants to divert attention, but that shouldn't be our concern in the United States.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. On the line with us is Jerome Corsi. Jerome is the author of six books, including his latest, Killing the Deep State, The Fight to Save President Trump, out this week. He's head of the Washington, D.C. News Bureau for Alex Jones and Infowars.com. You can tweet him at Jerome_Corsi, C-O-R-S-I. Jerry, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Tom. That was 30 books.
30 six books.
Six were New York Times bestsellers.
Ah, okay. Geez, you're beating me. That's impressive. Jerome Corsi, the reason I wanted to talk with you, and I realize that, you know, some of my listeners will be going, hey, wait a minute, this is the guy who started the birther thing that you know, nearly took down Obama. This is the guy who was, you know, the North American Union conspiracy theory. This is the guy who was published Atomic Iran, how the terrorist regime bought the bomb and American politicians back in 2005. You've attacked, you know, a whole bunch of
Don't forget Unfair Command against John Kerry.
Yeah, you took down John Kerry, basically, in 2004. So you've been very successful in promoting what I would say are basically lies, memes that have destroyed Democratic politicians with no merit. I think the John Kerry one is the classic one, obviously, you know, Barack Obama's birth certificate, another. You're now promoting this.
Oh, wait a minute, Tom, wait a minute. I like you. That's why I like to say things like this. Of course, I disagree with you that they're lies, but we can debate that another time.
Okay. But, you know, now you're coming out saying that there is a deep state trying to destroy Donald Trump, and that, you know, all the InfoWars people need to get together to save him. When his lawyer is running
the book,
a
by the way,
slush
killing
fund,
the deep state. Right. Let's at least plug the book. We're gonna
sure.
If you're gonna attack it, let's plug. Killing the Deep State is the title of the book.
Right, and the subtitle is The Fight to Save President Trump.
And it's been a New York Times bestseller for 4 weeks.
Great. Okay. So my question: you've got a president right now who certainly looks like he has been in bed with international oligarchs and crime figures for apparently, you know, since his last severe bankruptcies. In 2006, he started buying properties with cash, which is something that no real estate investor does because it radically decreases your ability to have leverage. But real estate investors who are just front men for money laundering operations do this regularly. Aren't you more concerned, frankly, that Donald Trump is going to end up in prison along with the rest of the Trump crime family than that, you know, there's going to be, you say in your book, there's going to be a backlash against Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama?
I always love your question. I always enjoy being interviewed by you, Tom. Look,
you,
Mueller's had over a year now to indict Donald Trump for any crime he could find. And I don't see any indictments with a team of really pro-Hillary Democratic lawyers hired. I would have thought they'd have found a crime if there was one.
Well, first of all, when indicting Trump is not part of his charge.
Bring articles of, recommend articles of impeachment.
No, that's not even part of his charge. You know, if you read the you know the authorizing legislation, it's that he's supposed to investigate whether the government of Russia specifically and more broadly any other government was attempting to influence the U.S. election, and if so, how?
Well, Tom, first of all, it's not authorizing legislation that put Mueller into the special counsel
role.
No, it's
Rod
Rosenstein's authorization from Rod Rosenstein, and we haven't seen it yet. It's been requested by Judge Ellis in the Manafort case, in which Judge Ellis suggested that the jurisdiction from that authorizing memo may have been so broad that Mueller is conducting an unfettered investigation.
So
my point
started.
Is, if Mueller had found anything, he would have by now produced either an indictment of someone, or he would have moved that for, you know, suggested
Jerry,
a finding.
What's your basis for that? I mean, you know, Ken Starr spent, what, 3 years and $74 million trying to nail Bill Clinton?
Well, we're talking about Bill Clinton. I mean, in terms
well,
of we're talking
about
Well,
he was the last independent prosecutor, the last special prosecutor. And it took him 3 years. Why are you saying after 1 year, you know, we've got to pull a plug on this thing?
Well, because there's nothing at all been found. The only
Ken Starr didn't indict anybody, you know, to the best of my knowledge, anybody at all. I mean, Mueller has already indicted 13 Russians, a half a dozen Americans. He's gotten guilty pleas from, what, four people, five people, something like that now? I mean,
and in fact, Tom,
he's producing
in every
results.
One of the major cases, the judges have already raised issues of prosecutorial indiscretion. That was also the case in the 13 Russians with this Russian troll farm, which, by the way, Justice Department said did not influence the election, didn't change a single vote. And Donald Trump was not involved in collusion with.
I don't think that the Justice Department made those emphatic negative statements.
Yes, they did.
Saying. Instead, what
I'll
they said
to,
was, we don't have the
statements.
Evidence. They said, we don't have the evidence. That's a different thing from saying there is no evidence.
Well, Tom, I'll send you the statement. They basically said that this case does not demonstrate any Russian collusion with Donald Trump. After investigating it, that didn't demonstrate any Russian collusion. And, in fact, the judge in the case has asked the prosecutors, what's the crime? And so, therefore, that's one of the three cases that I think the judge may rule prosecutorial misconduct. And I think it could be thrown out.
So you're completely ignoring all this autocratic, billionaire money that has been coming into Essential Consultants, LLC, Michael Cohen's little company that was used to pay off porn stars. And God only knows what else. You're just fine with that. Millions of dollars from Russian oligarchs.
It's not a crime to deal with Russians. We have to also investigate, find out about John Podesta. The WikiLeaks papers, his email showed from this company, Jolie, J-O-U-L-E, in the Netherlands, which was a Russian front company set up by Vexelberg, also another oligarch close to Putin. Millions of dollars worth through that account to Podesta.
So are you alleging that both parties have been corrupted by, in this case, Russian, by this particular oligarch?
I'm just suggesting if we're going to investigate one, let's investigate the other. But I'm also saying
okay.
that until there's proof There's no demonstration that simply working with Russia is a crime.
So your argument is, if the police have not yet proven that you're guilty of a crime, they should stop looking.
I always say alleged if you have reason to believe it, but I'm not going to identify that there was a crime. And
so,
keep
Jerry,
looking.
What is the sales pitch that you're giving, or the narrative, the through story that you're giving to your followers at InfoWars about specifically?
Oh, I see. How, my nutcase followers, what's my latest
specifically
wacko conspiracy
how
theory?
Obama and Clinton
you
are going to be
so
taken down.
You are so good at this. Tom. You're just you're beautiful. I love being interviewed by
Thank you.
Let me explain
what
the
is your storyline about how Clinton and Obama are going
to
be taken down?
Yeah. Let me explain the premise of the book to you. It starts out within the FBI, and it focuses on these what we have so far, these text messages between Strozek, head of the
FBI agents having an affair. I got it.
Yeah, two agents having an affair. And basically what they were saying was that they needed an insurance policy to make sure Donald Trump could be impeached. Now, in McCabe's office, these memos are occurring. And what seems to emerge.
That was a joke. I mean,
let me finish, Tom. What seems to emerge is the Russian, this dossier, the Fusion GPS dossier, which three times Comey signed on the FISA warrant application as supposedly evidence of Russian collusion. Yet Comey testified under oath to Congress that the FBI could not validate or authenticate that document.
They were able to authenticate the vast majority of that document. The one part that they haven't found yet is Donald Trump paying hookers to pee in the bed that Barack Obama slept in. That's the only thing they haven't been able to verify.
Tom, I'd like to go back and read you exactly what Comey said, because it was more broad than that. I assure you it was more broad. I don't have it in front of me, but I'd be happy to produce it for you. Comey said the claims in that document could not be validated or authenticated.
All of the claims.
He did list a single claim to Congress that had been validated.
Right, but we know that a number of those claims have been validated. But
you
haven't answered
that.
My question.
No, I'm sorry, I don't know that.
What is it that Obama and Clinton are going to go down for, Jerry?
Well, if in fact you have this electronic surveillance that was done on this false premises, or even if it had legitimate premises, when the data enters the White House, they are briefed and have the data on the electronic surveillance. The names are unmasked of the U.S. citizens under surveillance and leaked. They're leaked to the press. Now, that's a crime. And that's a crime in furtherance of damaging either Donald Trump's campaign or setting up the predicate for him to be impeached. And those are very serious. If those were crimes and were committed, they're very serious and need to be investigated.
So releasing classified information, sort of like WikiLeaks releasing Hillary Clinton's emails, is a crime for which we should go back and prosecute Clinton and Obama? Is that what you're saying?
Well, Tom, I'd hate to bring it up to you, but you might have read New York Times v. Sullivan or New York Times v. USA, Pentagon Papers case, in which Daniel Ellsberg case proved that even if the information like the Pentagon Papers was stolen and classified, the New York Times had a right to publish it. So as far as I can see, under U.S. law, Julian Assange had the right to publish the WikiLeaks papers.
So then what you're saying is that Obama and Clinton had the right to publish that information?
If it was given to them, Obama, anyone given classified information.
So if you're defending Obama and Clinton, how can you say that they're going to go to jail?
Hey, Tom, why don't you ask six questions and not let me get a chance to answer any of them? Your turn.
All right. Well, Jerry, we're out of time. I mean, this is not a minute and a half over.
Let's do it again.
Jerome Corsi, his new book, Killing the Deep State, The Fight to Save President Trump, out next week, or out apparently.
No, it's been out 3 weeks, 4 weeks.
Okay, I'm sorry. My notes
4 weeks
are
on the bestseller.
4 weeks
on the New York Times bestseller lot. No,
yeah.
Been out since March.
Got it. Okay, best-selling author, Jerome Corsi, PhD. Jerry, thank you very much for joining
me. My great pleasure. My always. My great pleasure.
Thank you. Bye now. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So are you buying it? Do you think that Obama and Clinton are going to go to jail because they tried to tell us what Trump was up to? Hey, I've got to tell you about the world's best chair. Most of us spend over 2,000 hours a year sitting in our office chairs, and if you have back problems or trouble concentrating throughout the day, there's a simple reason. You're sitting in the wrong chair. Take your chair, your style, and your productivity to the next level with an X chair. The X chair's unique anthropomorphic design and dynamic variable lumbar support cradle your body in a way you need to feel to believe. And a more comfortable posture means better concentration and much higher productivity. In fact, if you're a business owner, there's no better way to reward your top performers than giving them an X chair. And the X chair's sleek, modern style will upgrade the entire look of your office. Give yourself and your staff the gift that pays dividends 5 days a week, year-round. Feel and see the X-Chair difference by going to xchairtom.com right now. That's the letter X, Chair, Tom, T-H-O-M.com, or call 1-844-4-X-CHAIR. If you're not truly thrilled by the look and feel after 30 days, return it for a full refund. Order today and save $100 and get free shipping. If you go to xchairtom.com right now and enter the code TOM, T-H-O-M, you get a free footrest. That's xchairtom.com or call 1-844-X-CHAIR. We have one here. We love it. xchairtom.com. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's the True People's Media, the Tom Hartman program. Why is it that we don't look beyond our noses? Why is it that we you know, whatever's right in front of us, we go, oh, yeah, oh, look at that. And we don't go and say, well, wait a minute, if there's that, then there must be this. Case in point. In 2002, with the Help America Vote Act, the HAVA Act, the Republicans in Congress privatized our voting systems. Now, a lot of Democrats went along with it, but this was principally a Republican-led effort. And the rationale was, oh, we don't want those hanging Chad problems like we had in Florida under Jeb Bush, so we're going to privatize the entire voting system of the United States. We're going to bring in private for-profit corporations like Diebold, and we're going to have them run our elections, and they will tell us how we voted. And they're going to do it with proprietary software, proprietary hardware, stuff that we aren't allowed to see. We aren't allowed to know how it works. We're not allowed to, there's no open source stuff. We're not allowed to see the software. And we just trust them, right? ES&S, started by the Urichevich brothers, as I recall. You know, right-wing family. Diebold, Wally Odell, back in 2004, saying, as the president of Diebold, I look forward to bringing Ohio home for George W. Bush. We created a privatized voting system in the United States. We have had it now for, 15 years, 16 years, since 2002. It has produced something called Redshift. Google it sometime. Voting and Redshift, R-E-D-S-H-I-F-T. Like I said, you know, hit DuckDuckGo or Google with it, and you will see what I'm talking about, where state after state after state controlled by Republicans, suddenly the exit polls, which were the gold standard for the world, for years and years, to define whether an election was clean or not. When the Ukrainian election went for Yanukovych, and we went in and said, you know, the exit polls are 4% different from the election results. Actually, I think it was more than 4%. But there's a difference between the election polls, the election result, and the exit polls. And therefore, we're declaring the Ukrainian election null and void, right? It was illegitimate. It needs to be redone. We did that based on exit polls. But here in the United States, you're getting 6% and 7% exit polls showing Democrats winning in states where the election machines said Republicans were winning. And we're going, no big deal. Carolyn O is tweeting new. The Senate Intelligence Committee released its preliminary findings into Russian targeting of election infrastructure during the 2016 election. And this is where I'm getting into this. Why is it that we look at our nose and nothing beyond this? As I read the rest of this to you, let me just posit this one simple thing. If the Russians can hack our elections, so can the Saudis, so can the Israelis, so can the Iranians, so can the North Koreans, so can the French, so can the Germans, so can the Republican Party, so can the billionaires. If Russia can hack our elections, anybody can hack our elections, given that they've got the resources to do it. And all of those entities that I just named have the resources to do it. So why the hell do we have an insecure election system? So now, back to the story. Here it is. The Senate Intelligence Committee released its preliminary findings into Russian targeting of election infrastructure during the 2016 election. This is a quote from the Senate Intelligence Committee. Quote, in a small number of states, Russian-affiliated cyber actors were in a position to, at a minimum, alter or delete voter registration data. It goes on to say, cyber actors affiliated with the Russian government scanned state systems extensively throughout the 2016 election cycle. These cyber actors made attempts to access numerous state election systems and in a small number of cases accessed voter registration databases. At least 18 states had election systems targeted by Russian-affiliated cyber actors in some fashion. Elements of the IC have varying levels of confidence about three additional states, that's the Intelligence Committee, for a possible total of 21. In addition, other states saw suspicious or malicious behavior that the Intelligence Committee has been unable to attribute to Russia. Gee, maybe it was China? Almost all the states that were targeted observed vulnerability scanning directed at the Secretary of State's websites or voter registration infrastructure. Other scams were broader or less specific in their target. In at least six states, the Russian-affiliated cyber actors went beyond scanning and conducted malicious access attempts on voting-related websites. In a small number of states, Russian-affiliated cyber actors were able to gain access to restricted elements of election infrastructure. In a small number of states, these cyber actors were in a position to, at the minimum, alter or delete voter registration data. However, they did not appear to be able in a position to manipulate individual votes or aggregate vote totals. Okay, that's terrible. And I get it. You know, the Russians shouldn't be doing this. Nobody should be doing this. But why, you know, this is like a bunch of people who own a bank sitting around going, gee, you know, we've had three people come in the last 2 days and just take money out of the till and walk off with it. And somebody says, well, gee, maybe you shouldn't have the tills available to the public. Maybe you should put them behind a plexiglass window so people can't just reach over and grab a handful of hundreds. Oh, no, we wouldn't do that. That would be too difficult. I mean, this is crazy. Anyhow, back to your calls. Sandy in Los Angeles. Hey, Sandy, what's up?
Thank you for taking the call, Tom. Just by way of preamble, I spent 6 years in the Army. I'm a combat veteran, and I'm a lawyer for 41 years.
Okay.
I don't want to see us go to war ever again if we can avoid it. And I don't want to see us going to war with people like Pompeo and Bolton leading it. That's a throwback to Rumsfeld and Cheney.
Or worse.
Corsi, who is obviously not a lawyer, he's beating the Trump drum. Why hasn't Mueller? I do criminal defense for 41 years. I'm an ex-prosecutor. When the investigation is over, emphasis on the word over, the prosecutor, the special prosecutor, will reveal everything that he has, and it takes time. And there have been people indicted. And we all know that there have been people who have copped pleas already, who have pled guilty already. Right. The Republicans want it over, and they can go to their death thinking that it's going to be over tomorrow, because it's not going to be over tomorrow. This new revelation with the link between Russia, Michael Cohen, the $500,000 Essentials LLC, Donald Trump, is fascinating. I simply say it's not what one knows, it's what they can prove. And until the investigation is completed, thoroughly completed, we will not know everything that the special prosecutor's team knows, and these are really savvy prosecutors.
Yeah.
That's my statement for the day, Tom.
Yeah, well said. And I think that Corsi is just trying to throw sand in the gears here, which is, you know, what all the Trump apologists are doing. And
let me leave you.
Go ahead.
Let me leave you with this thought. A friend of mine called me from New York, very affluent guy. He said to me, you know, we used to think that Trump was stupid in New York. We don't think that anymore. Now we think he's a complete imbecile. So
he's been downgraded. Yeah. Well, I would say he's a con man. Right. He's a classic, white Christian mobster, you know, as opposed to the mafia, you know, the historically Catholic Italian. I suppose they're white Christians also, but you get what I'm saying. You know, he's a Protestant mobster.
Sure. One would have to suspend reality if they don't see anything wrong with this whole Trump-Cohn, Stormy Daniels, Russian connection. I mean, Hollywood couldn't do it any better.
No,
there's something there.
Yeah, I'm with you. Sandy, I want to get one more call in before we hit the hard break
Thank
here.
You
but,
much.
You know, spot on. Thank you, Sandy. Johnny in Lamarck, Texas. Hey, Johnny, you want to push back on Jerry Corsi?
Oh, yeah, big time, my friend. Listen, I'm listening to him. I didn't catch all of it, but I got enough to make me think, and I've had this thought lots of times, and I might have expressed it to you at least once or twice before, but extremists from his side, including Joe Bolton and all these other guys, and Rush Limbaugh, I would like for them to try to imagine living in a country without liberals. They couldn't do it. We're the ones that make life feasible and worth living. If you put all of them together in one country, them and evangelicals and all those crazy people, do you think they would work and live and get along well?
No, the country would look like Somalia.
Realize that they'd have to import a bunch of cheap labor, and then they couldn't deny the reality of life, that our economy is based on a big scam. It's like a Ponzi scheme, the way they practice capitalism. So here's my solution.
Go for it.
Okay. You take the extremists from our country, the religious extremists from the USA, and you take the religious extremists from Iran, because they've got their extremists to deal with too, the religious leaders. You put them in a desert country nearby. You equip a camera crew out there to follow them 24/7.
You want to do a reality show, Johnny? Is that the deal?
Yeah, and you raise funds from that for liberal causes.
Well, hey, you know, who knows? It could work.
Two birds at one stone. We get rid of them and we get some money out of it.
Yeah.
Using their own against them. The trick is you have to convince them to go. I don't know how you could have.
Well, the problem, Johnny, is that we've already done what you're talking about. We called it the war in Iraq. And you know, we created our own reality show. We, you know, the Bush administration embedded reporters to make sure that the reality show was as good as possible. And a lot of Americans bought it. And that's the sad thing. That's the frightening thing, frankly. Johnny, thank you for the call. Amazing times we live in. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
We'll be back with more of your calls and the news of the day right after this. And Senator Jeff Merkley will be with us in about a half hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the third hour of our program. We are blessed here in Oregon to have two of the finest senators in the United States Senate, and one of the very best, Jeff Merkley, is with us. Merkley.senate.gov is the website. You can tweet him at Sen, as in Senator, S-E-N, Jeff Merkley, M-E-R-K-L-E-Y. Senator, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So you and Ron Wyden are working with, I think, all the other Democrats and at least one or two Republicans on this resolution of disapproval, if I have the language right, which would reverse former Verizon lawyer Ajit Pai, the head of the FCC, reverse his destruction of net neutrality. Do I have that right?
You have that exactly right. We need a couple more members to join us and make sure that we have a majority next week when we vote on this to save net neutrality.
By a couple more members, you mean at least one more Republican, right?
That's right. When we checked on the rules, we believe that this we can win with 50-49 if Senator McCain is not here.
Mm-hmm.
But we would like this to be a much more emphatic vote. I'm hoping that when it becomes clear we're going to win, we'll have maybe another 20 or so Republicans join us.
That's remarkable. Now, in Europe and in South Korea, for example, in France, you can get, you know, 100 MIPS down, 50 MIPS up, plus your cell phone, plus your cable TV for under $40 a month. You can't get those guys, and the same thing in South Korea. You can't get those kinds of prices in the United States because those countries require whoever runs the copper into your house, whoever runs the pipe into your house, has to allow any internet service provider to provide service over that, like we used to do with phones. You dial up your internet service provider, whether it was AOL or CompuServe, you could pick whoever you wanted, it went over the same phone line. Is there any movement toward bringing competition back to the internet service provider business in the United States, number one? And number two, if so or if not, for that matter, how does that interact with the concern of numerous municipalities around the United States that are setting out to start their own broadband services, you know, without having to deal with the crummy service and insanely high prices of these for-profit companies like Comcast and whatnot, to AT&T?
Well, you're absolutely right to raise this issue of competition because we pay so much more for service here than anywhere else in the world. And you find that in the cell phone world, and you certainly find that in the broadband world. I do want to pause a moment and explain why this net neutrality vote is so important.
Mm-hmm.
This is a situation where the ISP providers would like to be able to sell a fast lane on the internet to those who can afford it and stick the rest of us in the slow lane. I'm sure that would increase their profits, but what it does is it creates an unfair playing field for our business. For a small business to be able to challenge a big business, they've got to have their pages load at the same speed. Otherwise, Amazon pages go, you know, flip, 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 while you're sitting there 30 seconds waiting for their competitor, and their competitor just isn't going to be able to compete. So if you believe in entrepreneurship or startups or small business are just an equal opportunity for all commercial players, you've got to weigh in on behalf of net neutrality.
Mm. And I know that you have to boogie here in the next minute or so, but thoughts on municipal broadband? I understand that Republicans are actually promoting legislation in some states that would make it illegal for cities to offer their citizens, you know, city-run broadband the way that they offer them city-run water or sewage or electric.
Yeah, such a ban is so anti-competitive. We see cities that were not served by commercial enterprises who jumped in and said, we're going to do our own broadband, and have made a very good deal of it. Sometimes then later it becomes in competition, and the competition lowers prices for citizens. But to ban cities from acting, I think is absolutely unfair type of law, and that type of preemption we need to push back against.
Yeah. So finally, for people who want to support the efforts that you and Senator Wyden are taking to undo Ajit Pai's destruction of net neutrality, they should call their senators in the Congressional Switchboard 202-225-3121 and ask for both of their senators ultimately and say exactly what to them.
They should say, save net neutrality. It's the only thing that's fair to our consumers and that's fair to our small business and our entrepreneurs. Don't come home and lecture us about your support for small business if you're trying to discriminate against them and make it impossible for them to compete.
Amen. Very, very well said. Senator Merkley, you're doing God's work. Thank you so much for everything that you're doing and for dropping by today. It's great talking
with
you.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you very much. Moving along, or just, you know, continuing along these lines, Anthony in Georgetown, Kentucky. Hey, Anthony, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Maybe I've had my head in the sand, but maybe you can clarify this. Trump administration, since their inception, they have confirmed six judges, and I don't know what kind of judges. I believe
hardcore right-wing cranks, Anthony. They're all Federalist Society members. Anthony's phone dropped. Amazing. Bill and Kelseyville, California. Hey, Bill, what's on your mind?
Well, you know, Tom, I was listening to a couple of callers back talking about the subconscious and the motivation of, or explanation of what they do. And the thought occurred to me a couple of days ago. I listen to your show a lot. I have a lot of respect. Anyway, back I was in radio back in the late 60s, early 70s, and we used to, quite frankly, there was a show in Orange County, which we used to call Behind the Orange Curtain, and it was, you know, the right-wing area. There's a guy on the show named Joe Pine.
Who I remember Joe Pine. He had a TV show on the... You know, my dad and I used to watch that together. He'd chain smoke cigarettes and throw out right-wing talking points.
Absolutely hilarious guy.
Well, it wasn't very hilarious. I mean, he was promoting some really toxic stuff.
Well, I got really stoned and watched him, to be honest with you. And, yeah, I mean, he was a cross between Jerry Springer and
Limbaugh.
Rush Limbaugh.
But what's your point, Bill?
My point is that I would think that perhaps how do you deprogram somebody who is that fanatical and get them to realize that perhaps their views are skewed?
I think that you have to do it on an issue-by-issue basis. You know, do you really want to end Social Security just so the bankers on Wall Street can make more profit? Do you really want to end Medicare and Medicaid just so that the health insurance companies can make more profit? Do you really want to deregulate the oil industry so that they can make more profit while they, you know, once again are catching our rivers on fire, polluting our water supply and our air, things like that? I really think that the way that we do this is issue by issue. Do you really think that a half a dozen or fewer, three or four very, very large companies should carry 90% of the internet traffic in this country and do it however they want and screw their customers in the process if they find it profitable? Do you really think that? I mean, you know, these are the positions that the Republicans are taking. They're all gung-ho for corporations and to hell with everything else. And I have a problem with that. Keith in Rapid City, South Dakota. Hey, Keith, thanks for listening to SiriusXM. What's up?
Hey, Tom. Just a little bit about the previous call. They were talking about Netanyahu.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember dating back early 90s, Netanyahu saying, oh, gosh, Iran's only, you know, a couple of years away from having the bomb.
Yep.
Then 5 years would pass. And he'd say, oh, they're almost there. And then 8 more years would pass. And
yeah, it's like the Friedman units. The, you know, Thomas Friedman kept famously saying, in 6 months, we'll be pulling out of Iraq. Right. Back to you, Keith.
And his lies have just been going on for decades. And, you know, what this just came out, last week that he got on TV and talked, you know, there's just nothing more than lies.
Yeah.
And, you know, American people need to know that. He's been doing it for decades.
Yeah, and I would refer anybody who's curious about this. I mean, Israeli politics is complex and multidimensional. And, you know, go to Haaretz, HAARETZ.com is the website, HAARETZ. It's the number two newspaper in Israel, and it's progressive. And, you know, they're just speaking right out against Netanyahu, or at least against, you know, much of this behavior. And I think it's fascinating the way that they're going after this. Keith, thanks for the call. Howard in Valley Village, California. Hey, Howard, thanks for listening to KBBR. What's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you?
I'm fine.
A little earlier, you were talking about the evidence of the messianic movement in Israel, and you had mentioned that you see signs. All over say Moshiach now.
Well, bumper stickers. Yeah, I've seen those bumper stickers. They typically just say it in Hebrew, but yes.
Yeah, so actually that's not their movement. That's actually from the Chabad. And it's not saying that, oh, Moshiach is here now.
No, but Chabad is Schneerson's thing, you know? I mean, it's basically a cult of personality around what is now a dead rabbi, a dead Hasidic rabbi, or a dead cult within Hasidism.
See, I don't think that's a fair characterization because they don't believe that he was Mashiach. You know, there's the notion that some people said and thought that he was, but you know, the whole point of those bumper stickers is that it's not that Mashiach is here now. It's more of a plea that, you know, that we need Mashiach. Now.
Yeah, no, I get that. But after Schneerson died, I mean, they sat around for days waiting for his body to you know, 3 days later, he was supposed to come back to life.
So there were some like that, but I mean
I remember it well.
Just, yeah, but it's not characteristic of the entire Chabad movement.
Yeah,
you know, and especially today. I mean, you know, if they honestly,
well, Chabad has largely reinvented itself as an evangelical / social welfare organization.
Well, what do you mean by?
Well, they evangelize to other Jews. You know, come join our cult.
I'm not part of that movement, but I think they do much more than that. You know, they try to get people who are disenchanted with Judaism, who are Jews and are disenchanted with them,
sure.
And try to get them more involved.
No, I agree, Howard. And by the way, the evangelical movement in the United States does the same thing. They reach out to Catholics, they reach out to mainline Protestants, and try to get them involved. Yeah, it's a fascinating thing sociologically. Howard, thank you for the call. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Scott in Asheville, North Carolina. Hey, Scott, thanks for listening to 880 AM. What's up?
I just wanted to ask a question. What do we got? You know, the nuclear deal being called off, basically, was who's making money on that?
Right.
I listened to the caller that was talking about the stock market and how the Republicans are making money there. I can't imagine why they're ending this deal in Iraq or Iran.
The military-industrial complex is going to make a fortune.
Just selling weapons?
Yeah, the war business. Well, not just selling weapons. I mean, once you've got a war, it goes on steroids. It becomes insanely profitable. And now that the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq have wound down to the point that instead of running tens or hundreds of billions of dollars in profit through the defense contractors who ring Washington, D.C., now they're just down to a few billion dollars a year in profits. They want another war,
right.
In my humble opinion.
Right.
And Donald Trump is perfectly happy to give it to them. So that's my take on that, Scott. Scott, thanks for the call. Ron in Chicago. Hey, Ron, what's up?
Oh, hi, Tom. Can you hear me?
Yeah, just fine.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, this is Ron Behman. I was on your show on some radical political economists, but I've also done some exit poll stuff. And I just wanted to add, since I've benefited so much from a lot of the call-ins to your show and, of course, you yourself, so I just wanted to add some info on that. The exit polls that we're talking about, those of us that are really concerned about this, are the unadjusted exit polls that are not the ones publicized by the major media. They're exit polls that we capture with screenshots right before they all get adjusted to match the official results.
Right, and prior to the 2000 election or the 2004 election, they never adjusted exit polls, at least not in any consequential way, to make them conform to the vote.
I don't know about that, but I tend to agree with you. I mean, I suspect you're correct. So the problem is that And we've tried forever to try and get the exit polling companies or private companies contracted by major media to release the precinct level data, some of the data, you know, without necessarily having to give us the exact precincts and so forth.
Right,
so
you can anonymize it.
Yeah, we were able to get that in one case in Ohio 2004, and we verified everything that we had been saying. The other point is so people that, you know, so when you say it's unadjusted exit polls, and the sample size is very close to what they get for, you know, what they report as the official sample size. So it's a good sample. It's before they adjust it, which they say themselves that they do. I mean, the exit polling companies are very open about this. They say, yeah, that's what we do. We adjust everything to match the official results when they're called. The other point is that I've looked at, you know, a lot of the pushback on this is that, well, exit polls are not reliable, et cetera, et cetera. The problem is, first of all, they generally are extremely reliable. They're used all over the world. The second point is that what happens in the U.S. is the bias is one-sided, and it's politically it's very correlated with politics. So all the battleground states, the deep Republican states, you get this huge shift against the Democratic candidates that makes no sense.
And they came up with this theory, Ron, of, oh, it's the shy, it's the embarrassed Republican voter. He's afraid to tell the exit poller that he's voting for George W. Bush, which has proven to be BS.
Exactly. So we did a study on that, and we showed that using their own data, this was Matofsky at the time, and now it's been taken over by Lenski.
It was Edison Matofsky.
I'm sorry?
It was Edison Matofsky, wasn't that the company?
Right. Yeah. And now it's just Edison.
Yeah.
But Joe Lenski was Matofsky's. He was, he was a second there. Matofsky was his mentor. There's a whole interesting story about that. But in any case, we in 04, we released all this data. So they're using their own data because they were trying to promote that theory of the shy Republican voter.
Right.
We took their data.
So,
and analyzed
Ron, I'm out of time here, but the bottom line is that we've known basically since 2004 that these machines don't work right. Right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Thank you. I got to run. Thanks so much for being with us today. It's been a fascinating day. Tomorrow will be another one, especially as these three North Korean prisoners come home tonight, 2 o'clock in the morning. That will be the next, let's grab the news cycle thing coming out of the Trump machine. In the meantime, don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It actually requires all of us to be involved. It doesn't work without you. So get out there, get active, tag. You're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.